These are the Target Files, taking a 21st century look back at the 20th century and now 21st century adventures of the Doctor in novelization and audiobook form, looking through the eyes of adulthood at our childhood memories. After all, a great Time Lord once said, "There's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish some of the time."
Hello there, this is the Target Files, and this is Alex in Exeter. This is episode 66, where we should be discussing the greatest show in the galaxy, audiobook, book and DVD, book and audiobook written by Stephen Wyatt, and read by Sophie Alfgrid.
Hi, this is Mike in Swansea.
On our Before podcast, discussed it before, has our views on it changed? I think mine has.
I'd say perhaps ever so slightly, Al. Overall, I found it a little bit too long. I sort of missed the point slightly until I listened to the commentary where Stephen Wyatt says on the DVD story was sort of an allegory or a metaphor for the death of the whole hippie ideal of the 60s, but I seemed to miss that as I just found it a bit of a trudge to listen to be honest.
Yeah, I think it is the... slightly, because you know, you've got that sort of hippie sort of planet with the bus and all that sort of stuff. But I agree with you. I think the actual the book can be a bit too long. I thought the actual TV episodes that were about right, but I think the whole concept does get a bit repeated, I think.
Yes, I think much better paced, as you've just alluded to, on TV.
I think the problem is the book has all the sort of other ideas that Stephen White wanted to put in the episode, and you know, the good editor, you get cut back, thank God.
Yeah, I mean, how do you feel he's expanded on it? I think we mentioned last time with Mark of the Rani, it had a bit more of a sedate pace to it than a few of the ones we'd done just before that. This one seems quite overly loaded with extra sort of bits and references.
Has a lot more to it. It does feel a bit overloaded when you see the planet for the first time and you meet all the characters and all the sort of... more sort of in-jokes between the Doctor and, you know, Ace at the beginning, where he's doing all the juggling and conjuring tricks, which, you know, as they say on the DVD, you know, Sylvester was made for this episode. It's just full of great sort of tricks and conjuring things. But I think sometimes the whole menace in the book slows down too much. It doesn't really come over right, I think.
I did actually enjoy the opening scene expansion in the novelisation and the audiobook, where we get the whole idea of, it's a wonderful idea really, a junk mail robot coming into the TARDIS in space and actually sort of being quite sort of rude to the Doctor and Ace, isn't it? You know, something that's invaded their home, more or less the TARDIS, and has sort of given them some jip.
Yeah, I really thought that bit was quite fun, you know, sort of, you know, where we all get junk mail through our letterbox every day, and it's all sort of going on, you know, to the next level with, like, we get spam and email and all that sort of these days. Sort of say you can't get rid of it, and there's a whole bit of Ace trying to kill the little thing off, and it still works. You know, you're forced to watch the advertisement for the greatest show in the galaxy. So I think that was quite a nice little thing, actually.
Yes, I suppose the modern social media equivalent would be... video pop-ups, wouldn't it? You know, the ones that start frustratingly on lots of websites.
Oh, yeah, I know, exactly. And when, you know, or the other thing, like with videos you can't tell not to stop sort of things when you hit the website, but you can start to do that, which is always annoying me. But it's a very good feature, and a good, I suppose it's a good way of you know, bringing in the circus and trying to make it a bit more, you know, technological, and this being a circus in the sense of being an actual circus.
Yes, adding a slight more of a layer, adding a layer of mystery to it.
One of the first ones where we start going for the more, which I always think is a good thing, the more darker Sylvester. I think the sort of jokey male era is just about to finish here, I think.
Yes, I think Andrew Cartmell alludes to that, doesn't he, on the DVD commentary?
Yeah, I think he does. He does mention how, you know, it was starting to get darker, and that's where he wanted to go with Sylvester's Doctor. And I think that's a good thing. I always think, you know, with the Doctor, you need both. You need the comedy, but you also need a lot of dark. I think, hopefully, we'll get that with Jodie, which I think we will get that with Jodie Whittaker, because he's brilliant at both. But I think you can see, because of the whole male pit, it was more fun. It was the Doctor on journeys with his friend base. Where I always think with Ace, it's more, and as he calls him Professor, so it's more trying to teach you stuff, really, thing again.
Yes, the let's be honest, the theatrical nature of Bonnie's long gone by this point, isn't it? And there's more of an equal role, I'd sort of say, between the two of them, more of just an understanding of getting on with the adventures rather than having the screaming companion.
Yeah, I think there's definitely that whole, you know, we're companions, we're people who know each other very well. You know, that whole first bit of the scene is about the whole Nitro 9 go missing and her trying to find it. And I think that's really interesting because it's not her not being an equal, basically. You know, they're on equal footing. But I still think there's that slight the Doctor knows more than she does thing. What very subtly done with Sylv's Doctor, I think.
Yes, and at this point she's still calling him Professor a lot, and that still seems to be annoying him.
Yeah, that's the one thing that does annoy him a lot, I think. And you sort of don't know exactly if she does it on purpose because she enjoys annoying him, so it sort of works well, I think.
Yeah, she's usually focused on something else, isn't she, when she calls him it, so I think she's just got into the habit by this point.
I think so. It's just a way of, you know, endearment, and sort of he likes it as well, I think.
Yeah, pretends he doesn't, but the old Sly Fox, Sylv likes it, doesn't he, really?
He does. And I think that with Big Finish Reason, having Mel and, you know, Sophie Alford there, they are really trying to shake it up again, I think.
Yes, on to the other characters, Al. I find it hard to remember them all, really, because do you think this is a bit too overly laden with lots of different names and characters?
I have exactly the same problem, but I think there's too many sort of two sides. It's like there's the one side where they're trying to still have the sort of reference to hippies, so there's sort of Flower Child and all these bits there, and then there's all the people from the circus bit. I can never keep up with all the names in the book. That's the problem I found.
I mean, one piece of controversy, it's mentioned in the commentary for the TV version on the DVD, is Bellboy. We see the idea of sacrifice and more or less suicide in this book, and it's put to the performers and Cartmell and Wyatt by, I think, Toby Haydock was moderating. Is it acceptable to show that in Doctor Who, you know, the whole idea of suicide, you know, albeit for sacrifice to help the others?
Yeah, I think so, because there's a, you know, he's basically doing that to help the others. It's not, you know, I'm suicide for the sense of suicide. But I think it's also very interesting, because I think in most of these episodes, and it wouldn't get today, they were just told, do what you like. You know, they got completely left alone. They could write a script how they liked it. They could, you know, film it how they wanted it. But if there was any problems, you could go back to, the boss, and go, that's what we're doing, and you'd stick up for you. I don't think that would happen today, really.
No, Al. You know, I don't remember it being a big controversy at the time. I think there would be now. There would be a social media outcry, I think. But you do have harsh issues like this in drama all the time.
Oh, I think definitely, and I think that's the point of drama. I think, you know, like as we just saw in a weekend that's gone, that the Three Girls drama won a lot of awards, and that was not an easy watch. But I think it needs to be put out there when it comes to drama. Now, I think today that would be an issue. I think, you know, there's quite a few things, you know, issues in these episodes, or in the episodes sort of very lightly done, where in the book they're quite heavily done, like, you know, the fanboy character who we all know is related to something else. But I think that's quite lightly done in the episodes, I thought, where in the book it's all a bit overdone.
I think the timing of the story, wasn't it, WizKid, played by Jan Simarco in the TV version. You know, a very enthusiastic sort of nerd, really, isn't he, of that era? And it was seen as a bit of a comeback from JNT, I think, from the open-air appearance of a certain young Mr. Chibnall the year before, and a few of the other members of the Merseyside group, wasn't it, of Doctor Who fans, and they'd had a bit of a go at Pip and Jane Baker, who'd appeared on that panel show at the time, around about 1986, and JNT over the phone that time. And it's sort of ironic now, isn't it, that Chris has gone and got the big showrunner's job 30 years later. You know, will he be a victim with the fact we've got social media nowadays? Is he going to be the victim of... similar criticisms.
Well, it'll be interesting to see, but I know there was a whole, you know, I watched those episodes, and I think the fan in the episodes is very, you know, you blink, you miss him. He's not a big thing. I never got the point of all that, but I think it will be very interesting because, you know, fortunately, Doctor Who fans have long memories, so it will be very interesting when Chris Chibnall takes over. We'll see what happens, but I think what I've seen, it's got quite a good friendly buzz around the production, apparently. So we'll see with Chris, but you never know.
Yeah, I expect it to be excellent, and I expect there to be severe criticisms, as you get in any era, really, from certain sections of fandom, don't you, who seem to excel in their cynicism, shall we say?
Well, I think we haven't had the big thing of moaning it from the old ranks of fans. If we're going to talk, basically they've slightly moaned about the Lady Doctor. What they're going to moan more about that? They're going to moan about it being 10 episodes, and they're going to moan about it probably being on a Sunday. Basically, those are the three things I'm going to warn everybody about. The moaning old Doctor Who fans are going to have meltdowns about that, I reckon.
But there are also cynical younger fans as well, Al. We shouldn't all bracket it in with
you. Yeah, that is true.
Because I'm a classic fanboy myself. You are, you know, from the McCoy era later on, so.
Oh, definitely. I think these, you know, all the classic things are great, and I'm looking forward to the box sets of all the classics coming out on Blu-ray, looking fantastic. They're going to be brilliant.
But to be honest, at the time, WizKid, I was just so excited to see. I'd seen in a TV magazine that Jansen Marco, who played Adrian Mole on ITV in the UK so brilliantly, was in this role, but I just remember being disappointed at the time, not for those reasons of seeing him as a nerd, just that his character was quite sort of flat. It didn't really go anywhere, and that comes across in the novelisation as well.
Yeah, that's the problem I have with it. It's sort of, he's there, and you think, you know, they could have really built this up to being, you know, somebody's, you know, really, you know, fanboy and sort of nerdy of that time, but he's sort of, you blink and you miss him sort of character. He's sort of, you know, there, but not there, really.
Yeah, it's one of a number of characters. I've used the word quite a lot in the last few episodes. Caricatures again, Al, isn't he, really?
Oh, definitely. You've got, you know, you've got the... I meant to ask you, is that actually Simon Callow playing one of the very, oh, I was in, you know, the in the theatre for years sort of character?
Oh, the sort of general.
Yes.
No, it's T.P. McKenna is a...
Oh, of course it is, of course it is. That's what I wonder, I always get confused with those two.
And a very...
But he's very much, you know, I've been in the theatre for years, but there was actors like that for years, you know. And I think there's a lot of stereotypes and the sort of people you'd find in the theatre and the whole clowns, which are very scary in this, I think.
Yes, and then we get on to the audiobook, and Sophie decides to play the that general chap with a Irish accent for some reason. It does sort of work in the novelisation, but I think I preferred it with T.P. McKenna in the RP pronunciation TV version.
Well, yeah, I think, he, you know, when he does his normal accent, he's a really strong Irish accent, so I think he must have heard him talking and thought, oh, I'll do it as his normal. I like you, I think it works better as the sort of, you know, person on the stage, sort of, you know, reminds me an awful lot of Henry Gordon Jago, that character does.
Most definitely. Was that Trevor Benjamin or...?
Yeah, that's Christopher Mr. Benjamin. That's
Christopher Benjamin, or Trevor, yeah. Baxter.
Christopher Benjamin Jago is...
Certainly reminiscent of that Victorian era, Al. And the Chief Clown, how do you feel he comes across? Very treacherous, both in the book and in the TV version.
Well, I think he's very well played in the episode. And again, I haven't worked out who that is yet.
Ian Reddington is the actor's name.
That's it, Ian Reddington.
Yeah, EastEnders at the time, gone on to be in many things since.
Yeah, he's very, very good. And he's sort of... start off thinking he's quite nice. I think by, you know, episode 2 or 3, really, he's quite scary, you know, like clowns can be, you know. That's all phobia, it's like, I never know what the word is for clownophobia, but it's people do suffer from it.
There is a specific name for it, I think. I'll
there is.
Google that later, folks, we can't be bothered to now.
it's just like, and then we get, you know, in the book it takes quite a while. That was our main... I think that last time we reviewed it, that was our main problem. It took an awful long time to get to the fun bit at the end, basically. But it must be me getting old, but I thought the end special effect, you know, where the tent completely blows up, I watched, and if you, that's another thing, if you blinked, it went, you know, we all know why, because it was in a car park, I think.
Yes, I wanted to mention that. Very well done, very memorable, very brave of Sylvester, as he wasn't expecting it to be that big an explosion, apparently, but he doesn't even flinch in the TV version. But it was one of those scenes I thought, how on earth could you get it across in the novelisation? But I think Wyatt does a pretty Wyatt does a pretty admirable job.
Well done.
of just sort of layering it and mention that it sinks into the ground, and he adds a fair deal of tension within.
Yeah, I think the last bit with the, you know, the, I'm going to try and say it, the gods of Ragnarok are quite good fun on TV, you know, lots of echo and that, and I think in the book they come over very well. That whole sort of big, I think it's the starting point of, is that the starting point of Andrew Cartnell's sort of big idea for Fen, you know, bringing all these gods in, I think, you know, with Fen.
I think so, yeah, cool. The idea the Doctor might be.
It's the starting point of that idea, isn't it? And you know, on I thought on the episode, it's like some voice, you know, it was okay. Well, I think that bit actually works better in the book, except for all the circus tricks, what Sylvester does in that bit.
Yes, the Doctor sort of might be something more than just a Time Lord himself, that sort of idea.
Yeah, and there's a great sort of theatrical bit with Sylvester, you know, being circus trained, is great sort of upside down, but it's just the part he was made for it. Well, I will say, I think you mentioned it quite early when we spoke earlier, how good this DVD looks on a 4K TV.
Fantastic, well worth a purchase, folks, still available.
It's only like £6 in HMV, but it's really worth it because it actually does stand, the bits in the circus and the bits at the end with the gods and Ragnarok really do look really good. And you're thinking, this is 30 years, it must be nearly 30 years old now, and it looks as good as a film today. Whenever they have the cameraman get it, because it looks really good on a 4K TV, and I think yours is even bright. Your Samsung's even brighter than our Panasonic, so I think it'll look even better if you've got like true motion on your 4K. Like, we haven't got that way. It looks really good here.
Yes, it does look very, very good.
Ending of this is a what is it? Would you call it a happy ending or sort of middle of the road ending? Because you know it's one of those ending of Doctor Who where sort of everything does get tied up nicely, and then you know they move on. But I just wonder: is the planet going to go back to how? Don't they put a new person in the ring, person running the circus? Is it going to go back to how it was eventually?
That's what we wonder about when we return to places in Doctor Who, isn't it? You know, what's going to be the outcome afterwards? But we get a few survivors from the original sort of hippie gang. Towards the end, the circus has been destroyed, and there's a lovely last sort of bit of manipulative language from the Seventh Doctor, isn't there, saying, I'm a bit like Ace, you know, I find circuses quite sinister, you know, and that just sort of sums up. It's almost looking within a mirror at himself as well, isn't it, about what's to occur in the forthcoming seasons.
I think so with this. It's sort of, you know, he looks at, you know, he's very tempted to join the circus, I think, the Doctor is, and not have all these extra things he only knows about and Ace doesn't, and what we're going to come later, which gets even, you know, darker with Fenric and Ghost Light and all the really, you're sort of in the start point or the really, really good Sylvester season, basically.
Yes, the cover, Al, 1989 published, Alistair Pearson, blue background of the sky, Sylvester blended into the blue with his hat on, with his cream top on, a big picture of him just above the circus tent itself.
Is that picture photoshopped, or was it actual, you know, there was nothing with Sylvester, I take it, like the other...
No, it's all Alistair Pearson's artwork. And then we have the split of the sky and the yellow sand onto the three gods of Ragnarok, looking at above the stone pillars where they sit within the circus arena itself. Stephen Wyatt, white words, the Sylvester logo, blended in from the starfield in the sky to the blue sky background with Sylvester's face. Greatest show in the galaxy in white. Yes, an excellent one, and they just sort of expanded it for the CD audiobook release a few years ago. Brightened it slightly, but used Alistair's main elements again. And yeah, it's one that I quite like. It shows you the circus tent. It shows you the three mysterious figures. It shows you the Doctor at the time.
So, scores for the greatest show in the galaxy. It's an very interesting one. As we said, we have reviewed this before, but not for our lovely new podcast we've been doing for a long time now. And, it's an interesting one, because back then, I think I wasn't the greatest fan of it, and I thought it got quite low scores, which now I think isn't completely fair, because I think the thing you need to do is watch the DVD first. Don't read the book first, watch the DVD, because the episodes stand up really well. They look really well, which is blooming amazing for being 30 years old now. And then read the book, listen to the audio CD, which is very well read by Sophie Alvord. And you'll probably, like me, give the DVD an 8.5, because the DVD is very good. And then the book, I'd say, I mean, the book is 7. I'm going to be more kind than I was before. And the audio CD, which is really well read by Sophie, I'd say a 7.5, I think.
Far kinder than me, Al. I'm not going to be quite as low as we were back in the day, but TV-wise, quite enjoyable. Somewhere between a 7, maybe a 7.5. As we've said, slickly edited, well-directed. The performers bring so much to the characters, which can be limited when you have one performer such as Sophie, as good as she is at reading audiobooks. But novelisation-wise, it just doesn't hang together for me. Too much chopping and changing. Just didn't interest me at all for too long. Like I said, I didn't get the whole metaphor. I should have got it, probably, about the whole death of the hippie era earlier on. Yeah, so many good concepts, though, like, you know, the old-style black cow in the desert and everything within the sand dunes. So many good elements, which, come to think of it, Al, it is just more of a visual story, and I just really can't give the novelisation or the audiobook more than a 5 or a 6. Probably a 5 for me, mate. Lowest I've gone so far. Sorry, Target Fans listeners. Sorry, Stephen Wyatt. Just a 5 for me.
It's 5 for Mike there. Well, I think I was being a bit more generous, so I thought I had to be a bit more generous after. I think I gave it a 3 last time, so I thought I'd have to give it a bit more.
I may have actually gone down since the old podcast.
I think you were a bit more generous. I think you gave it a 7. Like,
6
I
or 7, yeah, but no, I just... Oh, just a bit of a mishmash, really.
No, I was being kind of. I would agree. When I listened to the audiobook, I was thinking that again. It's like too many concepts. That is the problem. That, I think it's fine when it's on screen, because you have a slight editor in John Nathan Turner to go, no, that doesn't work. When it's a book, you can do what you want.
And a very, as I said, a very visual story, Al.
Yeah, totally visual. It's very visual from start to finish. And I have to admit, because it being too old for audio description, I was struggling a little bit, but I got by, basically.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
Hello there, this is Hughes News with Alex, and it's the 17th of May today. And first we've got to mention, unfortunately, the Tom Baker beautiful Blu-ray box set that's coming out was meant to be out on the 1st of June, but unfortunately has been put back to the 18th of June due to the fact that there's probably more extras, and the people from the regeneration team who are cleaning all the lovely episodes got delayed. So now out on the 18th of June. Well worth getting all of Tom's first season with loads of extras. At the BAFTA TV Awards this week just gone, Jodie Whittaker was there to present an award and hopefully win the Virgin TV Award, which is done by the public, for her opening 2-minute little thing that was shown at Wimbledon this year. Unfortunately, didn't win it, something else won, but was looking very on good form and enjoying the whole evening. And as Russell T. Davies has said, there's apparently a really good buzz on set in Cardiff. We can hopefully have a brilliant season in October. From BigFinish.com this week, we have Unit Cyber Reality, a 4-episode story involving Kate Stewart and Osgood, and this time the Cybermen, and something else as a treat, the War Master, played by the great Sir Derek Jacobi. From Big Finish, we also have from the new Big Finish Originals range, Cicero, a fantastic new dark drama about one of the original lawyers from Rome, It's got Samuel Barnett in, and it's been out as before as a pilot, but now we have a full series with lots of good actors and actresses. It's well worth a listen, and apparently, don't quote me on this, it's available for £5 on bigfinish.com at the moment. Well, my media recommendations this week, what have we been doing? Well, I could say Present Laughter, which I went to see at the theatre in Chichester last week, but that's finished now. Very good, with Rufus Hound and Tracy and Omen, a few Doctor Who people there. Music-wise, been listening to the new Arctic Monkeys album, which is very bizarre, no guitars, all piano, very David Bowie. Then we went a bit left field and listened to the new Nigel Kennedy album, which is Nigel Kennedy does Gershwin. Great fun, very chilled. If you're on a very early train, I recommend it. TV-wise, I have started Safe on Netflix. Very good, very edgy, grimy drama about a child who goes missing, so it's well worth a watch. Split's always very good on BBC, and there's another drama on ITV I haven't watched yet with Lee Ingby in, what looks good. Mike, I think you're ahead of me on the cinema. I need to go and see Deadpool 2 and Solo, which I'm going to do next week. How about you, Mike? What's your recommendations?
As you just mentioned, Al, Deadpool 2, a fantastic counterpoint, really, to Avengers Infinity War. Just, 3 weeks between the two releases? But the opposite end of the scale. Pretty non-stop sarcasm and laughs for 2 hours this time, rather than 90 minutes with the first movie. At one point, around about 1 hour 40 minutes in, I was starting to get a little bit grated with some of the sarcasm, but I soon chilled out again by the end, and it's got some of the best post-scenes credits you will ever see in a Marvel film.
Are they that good? Are they actually connected to anything, or are they just sort of standalone things?
Standalone humour within the... It's almost built up as you think, oh, something happens towards the end, this might turn up in Infinity War now, perhaps Deadpool's going to turn up, but it's sort of spun back on itself and to do with the whole humorous outlook of those movies so far. More of the same, Al, just they've laid it on again superbly. Reynolds is obviously loving the role, that really comes across in the performance still.
Well, that's good, because it was. I really loved the first one. I know a lot of people didn't like it, but I thought it was just on that sort of edge of where you could go with comedy. Like, not as far as Darren Baton Cohen goes with some things, but pretty far on the edge. And I thought it was quite good with the sort of sci-fi part in the first one. So I am looking forward to seeing Deadpool 2. I've got my normal problem in Exeter of only being able to get it into a certain screen on a certain day. So I thought this time I'd go slightly mad with my brother and go and see it just before midnight and see that and Solo on the same day.
Excellent, Al. Do you have a delivery of food in there when you're in there? And
No, I should do. I don't. I normally stick to water, basically, and probably keep it that way.
Much more willpower than me in a cinema, mate. Well, I usually go to Sainsbury's across the road where it's cheaper snacks than paying a fortune.
It's ridiculous. So what about TV and sort of stuff, Netflix and that stuff with you?
Well, I finished Breaking Bad at last. I think I might have mentioned that last time.
I've never seen it. I've put my hand up, so I've never seen it. Pay off you wanted.
Yes, it certainly does. Probably up there with The Sopranos as one of the best US TV shows for me.
The Sopranos was so perfectly finished.
And there's a spin-off about the lawyer, if you know Breaking Bad, called
I do know.
Better Call Saul, and it's a prequel, actually, because there's characters in it who don't last the whole of Breaking Bad. There's characters in it who don't last the whole of that series, so...
People said it wasn't that great, unfortunately, the prequel.
A few people I've spoken to online, posters on forums, have said they actually prefer it to Breaking Bad now, as I think season 4 is approaching of Better Call Saul, so... I wanted to mention, Al, terrible news Monday, we lost Margot Kidder, who played Lois Lane in the Superman movies.
Didn't you meet her at Comic-Con? I'm sure you've got a photo of her from Comic-Con.
No, last year she had to cancel, unfortunately, so it was supposed to be the three supervillains from that very first movie I saw in the cinema back in 81, aged about 4, Superman 2. Two of them actually pulled out, her and the gentleman Jack Albertson, who plays Non, the tall guy with the beard. Those two pulled out, so it was Terrence Stamp and Sarah Douglas I got a picture with. But I'd always wanted to meet Margot. You know, very, very gutted about that now that she's gone. Became a great activist for mental health and other issues later on in her life. But the chemistry is one of those special things, lightning in a bottle, like Tom Baker as the Doctor with Liz Sladen, really. It was that equivalent on the big screen. Reeve and her, I don't think they'll ever be bettered, you know. Henry Cavill's certainly struggling with the script for me. As Superman, they've gone in a different tone, which is the right thing to do, but it's just too dark, and you can't capture that magic in a bottle twice, I don't think, that you had with Chris Reeve and Margot Kidder.
It was just so good. It was just so how Superman should be, you know, somebody who was an alien from another planet who didn't really get the whole, Earth planet, really. Those first Superman films are still definitely my favourites. You know, they're just so much better. And I have to say, I don't really like Henry Cavill as Superman, to be honest.
Within a year, we've lost Carrie Fisher and we've lost Margot Kidder.
I know.
Unbelievable.
Do you think they're going to recast Carrie Fisher?
There was talk about Meryl Streep, but I don't think they will. I don't think that. I'm more disappointed that, having known that Carrie had passed a year before The Last Jedi was released, they killed off the character played by Laura Dern as well, because she would have been a superb general, I think, in Part 9.
Yeah, she would have been really, really good, I think. I agree. And
Holdo, wasn't it? Holdo, Admiral Holdo, or General Holdo.
One of those two, I think, would have been really good. Well, I have to say, I like that film more than I did.
No, but I did enjoy it, you know, probably one of the last midnight screenings I'll go and see. A lot of people criticise the portrayal of Luke Skywalker in that movie, but I found him as a flawed character. You have to...
But have you seen this whole theory that it was a complete little trick?
Oh, that he's not really...
But he wasn't there, and the whole of that was a Jedi test, apparently, like Yoda did to him in Empire.
Oh, so he's just going to turn up again in 9. No, I think the baton's passed with the final scene of the young kids with a broom, you know, pretending to be a lightsaber.
There's this really room, I don't even work, where you'll see in the first sort of 5 minutes of 9, Yoda, Anakin, and Obi-Wan, and Luke in this sort of Jedi temple, and you find out it was all a big Jedi trick, basically, on Rey.
So many different theories already, though, Al. We've got a year and a half to wait.
They haven't even started shooting yet. They're still in the mammoth training, what Daisy Ridley and all that will have to do for the new film.
But one of the best podcasts I listen to, if you've got into it, Al, is Blar Wars, a British one. It's brilliant.
I haven't heard that. Is that all Star Wars, is it?
Yeah, they've been going about a year now. They've got about 40-odd episodes. I think there's one out every Monday, and they brought one out for the 4th of May, May the 4th, and they're bringing a few out. I think they're bringing one or two or three out this weekend when Solo's released, so get on to that, folks. Blah Wars, B-L-A-H Wars.
I think I'm in the middle with Solo, because I want it to be so, so good. But I think everybody's going in there just thinking it's going to be a Harrison Ford rip-off, not giving the actor any chance, I think.
It's got some stellar names in there, you know, Woody Harrelson, Thandie Newton, who is amazing in Westworld, which I haven't caught up with season 2 yet. And she was in Line of Duty as well, very memorably as well.
So good in Line of Duty. I think, you know, people should just go in there with, like, I'm going to go in there with, like, this is a new Star Wars film. Don't go in thinking, where's Harrison Ford?
But, you know, Al, it's mid-May now. We are 4 and a bit months away from new Doctor Who, so can't wait. Hopefully a trailer soon, folks. I reckon within about 6 weeks, maybe the Football World Cup, we'll see a trailer.
I don't think there's a third, nothing. I'd love a trailer in the halftime of the FA Cup on Saturday.
It'd be wonderful.
Just a little bit of Jodie on set. We know episode 1, 2 and 3 is done, basically. It's done. But I think, like, I do have concerns for poor Jodie, because he looked absolutely manic at the BAFTAs.
Full of energy, really, and she did look slightly shattered as well, as they all seem to once they filmed that initial first series, or nearly got to the end of the first series.
It's that really hard schedule. I think you're doing lots of night shoots, and it hasn't been the greatest weather either, has it? Wales is nice, but it does get very cold, as we all know. It's interesting. Have you seen the list of the directors that's been announced for the episodes?
I had, but I've forgotten the names, Al.
The guy who did the reveal is like doing basically 1, 2, 7, 9 and 10 he's doing basically.
And I think one or two female directors following on from Rachel Talalay's sterling work in the Capaldi era.
Yeah, I think 3 and 4 has got a really good South African director to do. I mean, that's money must be in South Africa. But I think he did ask Rachel Talalay, but she was too busy on something she's doing.
So maybe season 11.
So, what do we think if they did do the Mother Big Room? A, they moved it to Sunday.
I just can't see it happening now because the US likes to get it the same day, and Sunday in the US is a very big day for, you know, the Walking Dead at 9 o'clock. I think Westworld too. So I can't see it going on a Sunday in the States. You know, you might say sadly enough pandering to the States again, but I think it's going to stay on a Saturday.
Yeah, but I think I'm hoping what Chris Chignall's done a deal with, basically if it stays on Saturday, it has to be blocked into this time, because you know it's strictly time period, unfortunately, in that time of the year, and they don't care about it. They strictly is the most important thing in their schedule at that time of year. I would have gone to the BBC, if you want it on a Saturday, you have to have it permanently at the 7:30 slot.
But as you said, Strictly's bigger, so they could just tell him to. It'll go where it goes then, couldn't they?
It's so annoying because, as you know, when it gets into the Strictly schedule, one week it'll be at 5 to 6, next week it'll be at 7:50, and every week you have to keep an eye on it because it changes because of Strictly's timings and all this. And then it loses that momentum, I think.
But, you know, I think with a Netflix era, I just honestly think ratings, they're important to the TV bosses, and that's it, aren't they?
Yeah, I think they're important to the TV bosses and making merchandise. Because I hear, on a very weird thing, I hear the solo merchandise isn't selling well, apparently.
It looks to be more of a film perhaps aimed at adults in the trailers, though.
Yeah, I think so. It looks very much like an actual adult action film. So I think that whole, you know, Woody Harrelson line and the way it's been shot, it looks more like a Ron Howard normal action film than a semi-teenage film, I think.
Absolutely, Al, absolutely. So next time, we are discussing another one of the new Target novelisations, which you've got your audiobook hands on and ears on, Al, haven't you?
I did indeed, and it's rather good, I have to admit. We'll go into more, and that is, so I'll say it is Rose by Russell T. Davis.
Yes, back to those heady dial-up days of 2005.
Oh, I love it. I love it. They were great, those era. And it's, of course, the audiobook, which I think is... Well, I'll say it. I'll discuss it more. I think it's better read this time with Camille... I'm going to say that surname wrong.
Cordury.
Cordury, that's it. You said it better than me. I always get that surname because it's a beautiful surname. I always get it wrong.
And with a royal wedding this weekend, she was actually in the movie King Ralph.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I shall be in the garden while that's on. I'm just there for the barbecue.
I shall be doing something else.
Yeah, it's like me. I'm at my mum's for the barbecue, the drink, and that's about it.
Next time, Doctor Who Target Files. We'll be discussing Rose, written by Russell T. Davis, along with the audiobook performed by Camille Cajuri. You can contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at DW Target Files, or search Facebook for our podcast page and leave a message. Thanks for listening. Doctor Who, Target Files. The greatest show in the galaxy review featured Alexander Gibbons and Michael Winks. 12th Doctor theme, composed originally by Murray Gold. Version for this podcast by Veil Mystery. Please do check out their YouTube channel, VAYLE Mystery. Newsround, opening and closing themes, composed originally by Ted Heath and his orchestra, and by John Baker. Doctor Who Target Files, the greatest show in the galaxy review, was recorded in Exeter, Devon, England, and Swansea, Wales, UK, during May 2018.